Naturally Speaking.
I'm Lori Baker. This is Naturally Speaking Shorts. Professor Tony Sinclair of the University of British Columbia has spent 50 years studying the Serengeti in East Africa, creating a detailed picture of the history and biology of one of the world's most well-known and highly treasured ecosystems. Tony, welcome to Naturally Speaking Shorts.
Thank you.
When did you know you wanted to be an ecologist?
I was born and raised in tropical Africa, Zambia, and then Tanzania. And from as far back as I remember, I was passionately interested in animals, wild animals, but all animals really. And anything to do with those turned me on. I did not, of course, know that I could turn that into a career. I was way too young for that. I was, you know, 5, 6, 7 years old. But it was in my blood, and it was obvious where it was going to go, even though I didn't know where that was.
And you had mentioned before that when you were in high school, you made a switch.
This passion was just something that I couldn't translate into academic activity. It was just something I enjoyed doing, and therefore, obviously, couldn't be in the classroom. You know, it was outside of that. And I went into science. I did hard science, physics, chemistry, maths. And it obviously had to do something with development and maturity. And at some point, as a teenager, I realized then that biology wasn't just medicine, but that it could encompass what I was passionately interested in doing. And that was an eye-opener. I finally found something that I was able to direct my activities. And I went from there. I did A-levels in 1 year because I had to switch. And then from that to scholarship, and there was no looking back. I was just consumed by this, and it was a passion.
Can you remember your first visit to the Serengeti?
That was very memorable. I went to Oxford as an undergraduate, and in my second day there as a freshman, I discovered a professor who was working in Africa. I was brash enough to go to his office and say, I would like to do research in Africa. What can you advise me? And he was so taken aback. His name was Arthur Kane, an evolutionist, and he said, well, I suppose you'd better come with me then. A year and a half later, we went to Serengeti. He left me there. He went on to Zimbabwe to look at his graduate student, and I started my research, which was as an undergraduate, and I started working on birds. My first day there, we drove down there, and I was taken out by a driver who was reading the rain gauges. So that required driving all around Serengeti. It actually took 3 days. It was just me and this African driver, and it blew me away. I realized then that this was such a remarkable place. I'd got experience of other places, and nothing compared to this. And I said to myself, this is where I want to spend the rest of my life. It was just too wonderful.
And what was the landscape like, and what animals did you see?
There are all sorts of different types of national parks. They were just developing in those days, in the 60s. This was wide open plains, grasslands. It was a huge area. You travel for hundreds of kilometers. Open plains, no trees, and then you get back into the trees, and then there's forest, and then there's hills. And so it was a magnificent array of different habitats. But I saw the wildebeest, I've never seen numbers like that before. Of course, been to Nairobi National Park and Amboseli and other places, but the numbers are just, there was nothing to compare. And so it was a magnificent experience, and I knew then where to direct my energies. That's where I was going to go. But at the same time, there were other people who had just started research. So the research had really only in its infancy. They'd been there about 3 years. And they saw me and they basically said, would I like to come back and do a PhD? I was only in second year undergraduate. And I said, well, of course. And so I had to get a scholarship. And I got a NATO scholarship, and off we went.
You've spent some 50 years studying the Serengeti ecosystem. What makes this ecosystem unique and what continues to fascinate you about it?
That's an excellent question, because it is unique. It is regarded as the number one conservation area of the world by general consensus. I don't know if you've heard of the World Heritage Sites. They were set up in 1972 when a group, the United Nations conference in Stockholm, got together a bunch of people and they said, wouldn't it be good if we could preserve the most important areas in the world as a United Nations sites? And so they said, right, all the delegates go away overnight and draw up a list of 10 most important sites to you. And they came from all over the world. And then they put all of these together, collated them, scored them, and looked to see what came out as the most important. And top of that list was Serengeti.
What made it so important to so many people?
I think they realized this was unique just because of not only the numbers. This was an intact migration, and so many of these migration systems had already collapsed through human encroachment and barriers and fences, and yet this one was continuing. They by that time knew a bit about it, had it properly documented, and at the same time, there was this great diversity of ungulate species. It's the most diverse area for ungulates in the world. So not only did they have the biggest migration in the world, but they also had the most diversity. And then there's the diversity of carnivores, the diversity of birds. So people were saying, how does this happen? So that's why it was unique. And of course, that question was the question I asked myself. Can I discover what makes this unique? And that's what took 50 years.
How have political, economic, and social events influenced the biology of this ecosystem?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because one of the things in my book, Serengeti Story, was to bring out that the fate of conservation really does depend on human activity, socioeconomic activities, and the history, the early history, going back in the 1800s, showed that the Industrial Revolution in Britain impacted the whole of Africa through the eradication of elephants in the 1800s because of the ivory trade, because of the import of ivory into Britain. And that changed the face of Africa, not only ecologically, it changed the habitats and so on, but it also changed the social system, and it's changed the politics. It allowed what's known as the scramble for Africa, the division of Africa into colonial countries that was set about in the German conference, Berlin Conference of 1885, I believe. All of that, those politics, changed the ecology of Africa and therefore the conservation of Africa in the end. We got a direct feel for this in the 1970s, when there was a conflict between Kenya and Tanzania, and they closed the border. That caused a collapse of the economy of Tanzania. That meant that there was no protection, there was no money for conservation, no money for anti-poaching, and it became a free-for-all for poachers, and they completely eradicated rhino. We lost 80% of the elephants, we lost 70% of the buffalo. Became quite dangerous. So those activities really dictated what was happening in there. Luckily, we turned it around in time before there was nothing left. But there are other parks in Africa which have basically been wiped out because of those sort of socio-political activities. So that's a very important understanding, that you can't just make a park and then think that it's just going to be there forever, because it won't.
In your recent book about the Serengeti, you recount the trials and tribulations as well as the successes of your and others' research. Why is it important to share this side of the research process?
Research does have to be communicated. If you don't tell other people what's going on, then you might as well not do it. Now, that's the general principle that we have when we write papers and talk to other scientists. But we have to do more than that, and we have to tell the general public what's going on. And there's something of a consensus that scientists are rather dull, people who are difficult to understand. They're very clever, but they only talk to themselves and nobody else understands them. You know, it's sort of maths on the blackboard and things bubbling in glass beakers. I want to say that science is much more than that, and that science is exciting. It's exciting to discover things, but it's also exciting to be out there in the wilds. And it can even be dangerous too. It's a great adventure, and I would like young people to read my book and say, that's what I want to do. It sounds like a great life.
And is there a favorite story from the book that you can share with us?
There are a lot of stories, and of course some of these stories can take too long. I guess the one that I think is the most remarkable was I had been called back to Serengeti to count the wildebeest because nobody had counted them for 4 years, and I was in Canada, and my friend Mike had written and said, we've got to do a count of the wildebeest. The last count had been 700,000 wildebeest. And nobody knew what was going on. They'd been going up and up, and we wanted to know, are they still going up or had they stopped? So we came back, and it happened to coincide with the closure of the border between Tanzania and Kenya. And these two countries were almost at war. Mike flew in with his British registered plane, and we flew over the Serengeti herds of wildebeest, taking photographs, vertical photographs, which is the way we do our counts. What we did not know about was that the Tanzania army was coming up across the plains because they had heard that it was about to be invaded from Kenya. And as we flew back and forth across this convoy of military, we were taking photographs. We did not notice this, but they did. When we landed, the Tanzania military arrested us for spying for Kenya because Mike had flown in. And we were arrested as spies. We were then locked up and we had to wait while they decided what to do with us. And they put a guard on our plane. After 2 days, we noticed that the guards changed guard by walking back to their camp. Instead of the one from the camp coming and replacing the one on the plane, it was the other way around. So there was a 45-minute gap. And having noticed this, we waited until the guard left, and we raced to the plane, we jumped in, and we escaped. Unfortunately, we had no fuel in the plane, and so we could only go a little way. And we went to Olduvai, where Mary Leakey was, and hoped that she had some avgas fuel for the plane. Luckily for us, she did, but in return, she asked us to take her to Nairobi because she was sick. Mary Leakey is a very famous archaeologist, who discovered the footprints, 3-million-year-old footprints. And that meant that we had to go through immigration, which we had no intention of going through. But at that point, they asked Mary to come into an office, and we thought, oh no, the military had caught up with us and we were going to get arrested not only for spying but for trying to escape. And there was a very tense moment, and then she came out and said, Mike, what have you been doing? And we tried to look very innocent, and she said, they think you're a terrible pilot and that it was not safe for me to fly with you. So we escaped, got back into Kenya.
I was very interested when you mentioned in your seminar that you had often got it wrong and that's how you ended up going back and learning more. Could you tell me more about that?
You don't really understand when you first see something what's happening. So you have to make an intelligent guess, and quite often that guess is wrong. But as you collect data, you're basically testing. That guess is officially a hypothesis, and you're testing that hypothesis, and provided that that hypothesis is testable. That is, that one can get data to make sure that it's either right or wrong, that so the data can show that it's wrong. Provided you can do that, then it doesn't matter what the hypothesis is. You just keep an open mind, and you're not sold on any particular idea, and that you're quite happy to accept that you got it wrong. There's no harm in being wrong. What is harm is sticking to an idea and denying that you're wrong. I think the lessons that come out of all of this are that you have to understand history in order to understand what's going on now. If you come into a system and see something happening, you almost certainly can't understand it properly, or you'll get it wrong, unless you understand what has happened in the past. That was one of the major things that have come out of it. And the other thing is that things change all the time, and that we have to be able to accommodate that change. Unfortunately, again, when you first come into a system, you don't know what those changes are and how they're taking place and what the magnitude is. All of that has to come from looking at a system for quite a long time.
One of the focuses of your future research is on whether we can reconstitute ecosystems that have been degraded. What have you learned so far?
I think the way to answer this first is to say what we've learned is that protected areas are absolutely essential for conservation, but that they're not good enough. They are actually not sufficient, and they can't preserve all the species. Even the ones in the park can't be preserved, and they're not big enough to preserve all the species in the world, maybe only half of them. And that requires us to look outside of protected areas and ask, what can we do there to protect species? And what we've learned so far is that most of those areas outside are so degraded that they're not much good for anything. You can grow wheat in a place or corn, but you can hold very few other species. So what we have to do is to come up with ingenious ways of improving the habitats so that more species can live there alongside humans. And two things. One is we have put almost no effort into doing that. And secondly, we put even less effort into measuring how well we're doing that. And so these are the two areas that I would like to encourage other people to start working on. Because for myself, I'm getting to the end of my career and I can't do it myself, but I would like to see other people now refocusing conservation on those areas.
What is your advice for young ecologists hoping to enter into this field?
Stick with your passion. If you've got a passion, go with it and don't worry too much about where it'll take you. Sometimes a student will come in and say, I don't really want to be labeled a behavioral ecologist or a disease person because I don't know that it's going to get me a job. I say, forget that. Do what it is that you're interested in. And life will take you where it'll take you, and jobs will come along eventually. You can't worry too far into the future. What you must do is use your passion to do a good job of your immediate present.
And is there anything you would like to add?
I'd like to see more young people coming in and asking questions and seeing how they can not only do conservation, but do it in a systematic and quantitative way as a scientist, because it's only by doing that that we get to the truth and can follow how things work.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Naturally Speaking podcast. If you've got any ideas for future shows or want to get involved, then please contact us. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is naturallyspeakingpodcast@gmail.com. Naturally Speaking is a podcast from the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine at the University of Glasgow. For more information, you can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter at the NS Podcast. And you can download future episodes and find more information at our blog at naturallyspeakingpodcast.wordpress.com.